Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think change. Think PwC. Think beyond. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we'll be taking a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Dr. Muireann Lynch from the ESRI. Muireann, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, the development of data centres around the country has been raising some questions this week, and in fact further back to that with the publication of the Climate Action Bill. Before we get into the possible concerns and consequences of the number and intensification of data centres based here in Ireland, let's remind ourselves of how central a player Ireland has become in the sector with Microsoft President Brad Smith.
Microsoft was the first tech company to invest in Ireland. This was in the 1980s. We put our manufacturing of software at the time on CDs and DVDs in Ireland. But the Irish government recognized in the 1990s that the day of software on CDs would come to an end. And if the Irish economy was going to continue to be prosperous and create more jobs, it would need to look to the future. So they came, and I still remember it was a visit led by an Irish official, Ronald Long, and they made the case, build your first data center for Europe in Ireland. And I looked across the table and said, look, we love Ireland, but we can't. The reason we can't is there is no high-speed fiber optic cable connecting Ireland with the European continent. And without a cable, it doesn't make sense to have a European data center. And the Irish officials looked across the table at me and said, give us 3 months. And given how much we had benefited from our work and our employees here in Ireland, there was no way we could say no to that. And 3 months later, they had the contract in place. They were well on their way to having the fiber optic cable in place. And you look today, I'd say the rest is history. You know, we believe that Ireland is to data what Switzerland is to money. People want to store their money in Switzerland. They should want to store their data in Ireland, because we really see Ireland as a country that has been on the forefront of cloud computing and data storage. It is a data superpower.
Microsoft President Brad Smith speaking to us there on Taking Stock a few months ago. Ireland, a data superpower. That sounds great, and I suppose the government can say that it backs up our foreign direct investment strategy generally, Muireann, but there's a downside to us becoming so top-heavy with data centres. There's 54 of them here already in the country, a lot more under construction and in planning. They consume huge amounts of energy. They create carbon emissions despite the ethereal sounding of the cloud, and that has to be paid for.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the things about data centres is they like to all be close together, physically close together, because if one of your data centres goes down, you and I sitting at home don't want our Netflix streaming to suddenly be interrupted. They want to be able to hop to the next data centre immediately. And this is just in kind of the worst case scenario, but they still want that locked down. So they do want to put all their data centres in the one place, but they are very power hungry, as you say. Another feature of data centres is their power output is pretty constant. So it doesn't go up and down during the day like the demand for lighting would, for example. We turn our lights off when the sun is up, we turn our lights on when it's nighttime. Whereas data centres consume the same amount of power all the time. That can be a nice feature to have on the system, but it still means that it's sucking up an awful lot of what we call baseload power. And baseload can tend to be the more carbon-intensive power, such as coal, etc. So reducing variability in electricity demand is good, but this doesn't really reduce variability in electricity demand. It just sticks on a bunch of extra demand that doesn't really move. And that does consume electricity, which does produce emissions. There's a question to be asked. If all these tech companies want their data centres all put together and they want to store all of their European data in Ireland, then we kind of need to ask the question, well, these data centres are consuming power in order to serve the data needs not just of Irish people, but French people and Italian people and German people and Danish people all over Europe. And there's almost a carbon leakage question, which is the data services are being consumed all around Europe. But the power to produce those data services and the emissions from that power are concentrated in Ireland. So you could try to make a case at European level that Ireland actually shouldn't have to have all of these emissions accounted against our national output of emissions. We've tried to make a similar case in agriculture, but it's a difficult case to make, and I haven't really seen much progress in making that case at European level to date.
If we were to make that case, though, couldn't our European member state colleagues come back and say to us, hang on, it's not as if your government, in outlining its strategy, didn't realise how power-hungry data centres are, their carbon emissions quantities. Not only were you aware of it, you have actively encouraged the concentration of data centres here through your planning, programmes and other incentives.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, which is why perhaps if they did try to go down that road, they wouldn't make much progress. It's different from agriculture in that we have a natural competitive advantage. We have the type of land and the type of historical expertise in that area. This is something that we literally decided to go after. And that was a brilliant clip that you played there showing exactly that.
And, you know, as we use our devices, whether it's Netflix, as you say, or looking up information on Google on our phones or whatever, we don't tend to think as consumers as that process of pulling stuff out of a data centre, probably in Ireland, we don't think of it as being carbon consuming and polluting in that regard.
No, not at all. I mean, it's difficult to get your mind around. You know, kind of if you just store a file on your PC, you fire up your PC, you click on that file, it opens up, it's stored in the memory of your own PC, and your own electricity in your own house powers that. Whereas if I pull up Google Maps on my phone, what's actually happening is there's a disk somewhere in a data center somewhere that actually starts spinning that infinitesimally amount faster, which requires that power. And also the fact that I was able to access it in the first place means it had to be online all the time. So it's really difficult to think of me pressing a button on my phone means I'm drawing down some power in a completely different data center on the other side of the country, potentially. It's difficult to get your head around, but we still are where we are, which is that they are massively increasing the demand for electricity in Ireland, far more so than any other European country.
Now, the technology companies themselves will say that one of the reasons that they are locating their data centers here is because of our temperate climate. In other words, there is less cooling down of these huge banks of servers and computers required than if they located elsewhere. Nonetheless, Airgrid, the energy transmissions semi-state company, has estimated that with the number of new data centres likely to come on stream in the 2020s, the data centres alone could consume about 30% of all electricity generated in Ireland by 2030. Apart from anything else, that's way out of kilter with most other countries.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, most countries are seeing their electricity demand stagnate or decline because their populations are stagnant, their populations are more or less fixed, and energy efficiency is increasing. Whereas in Ireland, we're seeing our electricity demand increase, and it's due to data centres. That's it. It's not due to our population is increasing, but it's mostly due to the data centres. And this has never happened before. Like, the increase in electricity consumption has always been driven by increase in economic activity. It's never been the case that one particular sector just exploded our electricity demand like this. The cooling, trying to find new ways of cooling them, make them more energy efficient, this is something that is active research going on. Also, there are different European countries that use what's called district heating, which is where you use the waste heat from a local source of energy to power, to heat the houses or maybe a hospital or a business campus nearby. There are also some data centres that are looking into that. So can they use their waste heat to power the heating of a nearby housing estate or something like that? These are some options that might help reduce the impact somewhat, but it's not going to completely mitigate it. And another problem as well, because most of these data centres are going to be located around Dublin, is it has an impact not only for the electricity generation side, but also the electricity transmission side. So this is the wires. We're going to need to upgrade them significantly if we don't want there to be massive congestion in the electricity network in Dublin itself. And if there is too much congestion, then that could potentially lead to blackouts or brownouts, and that's not what you want.
Yeah, I think the Irish Academy of Engineers estimates that about 9 billion euro of additional energy infrastructure would be required if all of the planned data centres come on stream over the next 10 years. And I suppose we will foot the bill for that one way or the other. In the government's climate action bill that went through, that was brought into the Oireachtas this week, and you know, which has been criticised by politicians and others as not being ambitious enough in terms of trying to cut our emissions, nearly every industry sector, apart from the data centre sector, has very ambitious and stringent carbon emission cut targets in place. The government seems to be turning a blind eye on this, even though the planned Amazon data centre in Mulhuddard, West County Dublin alone could consume about 4% of our national electricity generation.
Yeah, okay, so there's a couple of things in that. So first of all, because power is the main component of a data centre's cost base, they already have a massive incentive to be as energy efficient as possible. And they are doing what they can to be energy efficient. What they are also trying to do, and you could ask whether this is at the behest of the government or this is just something they want to do themselves, is they are investing significantly in renewable power because they want to be able to say that their data centres are powered a high proportion or even exclusively off renewable power. But increasing investment in renewable power is not costless. So Amazon Web Services, for example, has invested in renewable power in Donegal. But again, in order to get that renewable power into the areas of consumption, the cities, we need to invest in the transmission network, and Amazon are not going to do to cover that cost. That cost falls on the Irish consumer. So it's very difficult to disentangle all the different levels of the cost. And even if they are able to say, we have completely invested in all the power necessary to keep our data centres running, and it's all renewable, that still doesn't mean that it's costless for the Irish consumer because of the extra infrastructural costs on top of the extra generation costs.
And apart from the strain on our energy generation systems, apart from the extra carbon that it'll pour out into the atmosphere, putting strains on our carbon cut targets, you've been looking at the way renewable electricity is subsidised generally now, and the huge amounts of renewable energy that these data centres will consume, putting additional costs on consumers, businesses and large industry players through the 20s.
Yeah, so at the moment, so our renewable electricity target for 2020 was 40%, and the target for 2030 is 70%. So to take a very simple figure, let's say the data centres give rise to an extra 1,000 megawatt hours of demand in 2030. That means that we have to increase our renewable output by 700 megawatt hours of demand in order to meet that, in order to make sure that the 70% target is maintained. At the moment, the way we make sure that happens is through subsidisation of renewable energy. And the subsidy costs are borne by different consumer groups. Now, because those data centres have a very flat demand profile, they actually won't bear the entirety of the subsidy costs themselves. So they're bringing more demand onto the system, which means they're pushing up the requirement for renewable electricity. But that subsidy cost doesn't wholly fall on them. Part of it falls on other consumer groups, such as residential consumers and small commercial consumers. Now, if the data centres decide that they're going to completely fund their own renewable power privately and outside of the subsidy sector, then this isn't a problem. But for whatever section, whatever proportion of their demand that they don't fund or that they don't meet through their own renewable power, through a power purchasing agreement with a third party or whatever, that cost is going to fall on the Irish consumer. And it could be considerable depending on what the subsidy costs turn out to be.
We're already paying for the renewable energy that's generated in Ireland at the moment through our monthly ESB bills, our electricity bills, and industry is doing the same. That could increase for wind generated energy by anywhere 2-4% if all these data centres come on stream, and by up to 40% if it's solar energy that's used to power them.
Yeah, now, I mean, the figures that we used for solar in our original paper are disputed because it was early on. Now, we're going to have some renewable energy supply auctions next year for the first time, and we'll be able to see what they're coming in at. If it is the kind of figures that we used in our research, then yeah, we're talking really big increases in the subsidy costs. But let's hang on and see what exactly comes out of those auctions next year. Solar will probably be more, almost certainly be more expensive than wind, but it may not be as more expensive as I was anticipating. I might rerun those figures when the results of the RES auctions come out, and just to see what the difference actually is.
One of the consequences of the, I suppose, the infamous planning process for Apple's planned enormous data centre in Athenry was that companies like Apple and their peers don't need to do detailed environmental impact statements when they build out huge data centers. Do you think that's a gap in our strategy towards data centers?
It's difficult to say. I mean, in general, what economists would advocate is a level playing field in terms of regulation. So if anyone has to do an EIA, everyone has to do an EIA. The particular legal nuances behind it, I'm not sure of, but there has been an awful lot of discussion about trying to streamline the planning process in general. There may be some wisdom in that, and in order to try to stop these things being held up for protracted periods of time in the courts. But what the main thing I would say is there, you would get into difficulties, state aid difficulties, etc., if you were to just exempt a particular category, such as data centres. You could exempt a particular category in terms of something that's of significant public interest, for example, but I don't think we could just give a free pass to data centres for whatever reason.
They don't create an awful lot of employment, but I suppose the government's approach is, and perhaps backed by IDA Ireland, is that if they have their data centres here, their other operations are more anchored here as well, with all the benefits that that brings. But you referenced perhaps looking to Europe for some support here earlier. Do you think that we definitely need to think, as more and more data centres come on board and consume more energy and increase our carbon output, do you think we need to think more in a more focused way about how those costs are paid for, who pays for them? Should the multinationals themselves stump up more?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I suppose one of the differentiations I try to make is it's not a policy decision whether or not data centres are built. You know, we could have the worst investment landscape in the world, and if someone still wants to build a data center, they can. We can't ban them so long as they get planning permission, etc. I mean, there's nothing to stop anybody getting a grid connection and consuming electricity. And there are other sectors, such as the pharmaceutical sector, for example, consume a significant amount of power. But what we can do is we can set up an environment that makes it more or less attractive to put a data center here. And it seems that the policy so far has been, let's have a really attractive policy environment for data centres. It's kind of just said, but never really proven or justified, that if they put their data centres here, they'll put everything else here. I'm not really sure why, because it's, as you say, it's essentially just a great big box that sucks down a lot of power and doesn't employ many people. But if it is the case that the tech companies themselves are the ones who are insisting that they all go in the same place, and if it's kind of out of the Irish government's hands, then there could well be an argument for saying we need to come up with a carbon consumption model rather than a carbon production model for Europe, where we tax carbon at the point of consumption rather than production. That would also tackle the issue of, for example, goods being imported from high carbon China as opposed to being manufactured in low carbon Europe. But that's a part of a, everybody agrees that taxing carbon consumption rather than carbon production is a good thing to do, but it's very difficult to implement because then you need to get into import tariffs, which is not something that we like to use.
We leave it there, a fascinating debate, and one perhaps we should all remember as we click and try and retrieve information on our mobile phones or devices from now on. Dr. Muireann Lynch from the ESRI, thanks indeed for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think change. Think PwC. Think beyond. PwC.ie.
We're joined now by Rob Hartnett, the founder and chief executive of Sport for Business. Rob, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent. Always a pleasure.
Now, we're talking about the impact of hosting Olympic Games in major cities. We read this week that Tokyo, which hosts the Olympic Games this summer, already an independent audit of the likely cost there puts it at perhaps six times over the budget that the government says so. A trillion yen, however that much that is, I don't know. But there's a long history of cities going for the Olympic Games and then going way over budget and almost bankrupting cities in some ways. Montreal was probably the start back in 1976.
It was indeed, and there's been very few that you could say have honestly and genuinely turned a profit on it. I think most cities, even back in the day, would have considered the prestige of being an Olympic city as being worth the investment. But from a cold-hearted financial perspective, it's very, very difficult to make it work. I think the key to it, and probably if you look at, you know, at one of the cities like Los Angeles that would have done very well out of it and would have actually sort of made a good impact.
It's one of the few cities that have actually made a profit, however profits are measured.
That's right. And probably no secret in the fact that it's returning to Los Angeles now in another eight years' time. I think that's an important marker. The fact is that the cities that do well out of it would tend to be ones that would utilise a lot of the facilities which are already there. Now, London was slightly different in that they did build an Olympic Park and regenerated that whole area of the East End of London. But if you look at some of the real disasters, Montreal, as you correctly point out, was one of those that just started out badly and just kept on getting worse. That they had this idea of building a very fancy stadium in the middle of the city, which was completely unfit for purpose other than as a landmark for the Olympic Games. But the Olympic Games, we're very familiar with the fact that they are wonderful and very much in the spotlight. The world is watching for a couple of weeks once every 4 years, but a property like that has got to deliver over the long term and be consistent. And there's none of the major teams that are in Montreal that would be anywhere near using that stadium still. So I think that Los Angeles, you look at the LA Raiders were still using the Coliseum in Los Angeles up until the end of this NFL season. So building on facilities that are already there and making use of them is something which is really the key to actually having a successful Olympic Games.
And there seems to be a pattern there that cities that may not have a major tourist throughput through them anyway on a year-round basis, like Los Angeles has, and cities that basically are in countries that have economic challenges, the likes of Athens in 2004, the likes of Rio de Janeiro last time out, they really can bankrupt a city and leave all sorts of white elephant buildings around the place, can't they?
It can, because I think the upside is potentially less because you're already operating at near capacity. Like even if you look around in Dublin, we're never going to host an Olympic Games. But even if we were, our hotel capacity is pretty much maxed out during the course of the summer months anyway. So why would we want to bring on board a tournament or an event like that? One that is that might have slipped under the radar, though, is Barcelona. Barcelona as a city was nothing like the world centre that it is today up until 1992 when they hosted the Olympics. And prior to that sort of massive infrastructural investment that they made, the Olympic Games the city's nearest international airport was about 40 or 50 kilometres outside of the city. And then they built an airport in order to bring the Olympics in. They also redeveloped the entire harbour area there, which is a wonderful, really vibrant part of what is one of the world's leading cities now. It wasn't anything like that until the Olympics. So whether that was a degree of confidence that it gave the city and the Catalan people that they could do something like this, but that was transformational. And even if it didn't make a profit in the same way as Los Angeles did, it certainly put Barcelona on the map. It hadn't been there beforehand. It certainly was then, and it has continued to this day. So that's nearly three decades worth of payback that Barcelona has been getting from bidding for the Olympics.
I suppose those relatively successful cities, the likes of Barcelona, as you referenced, the likes of London in 2012, which had been dubbed the recession games because of the huge financial crash, but they did a good job and they pared back their budgets. How you measure success, I suppose, is important. Is it over what period of time and what are you measuring? As you say, huge amount of new housing built in London's East End. A lot of those sports facilities are used on a regular basis, have hosted major games since. And yet, the key Olympic Stadium itself, the City of London Stadium, I think West Ham United use it now, but it's a huge ongoing loss to the city.
It is, and if you were to know now what you know then when London was bidding for the Games, maybe they would have looked at it slightly differently. But that was a societal decision to invest in the infrastructure around a part of London that was effectively finished. And there were a number of smart ways that they did it as well. So the media centre at the London Olympic Games was then transformed into the BT Sports Studios. So it became a living, breathing legacy from the Games, so that you've still got a continual throughput of people, of businesses, of investment, and everything else that goes with that. And Stratford in East London wasn't a good area. Time had passed it by. Now you go to it and it's really vibrant. You've got the big Whitefield shopping centre that's there, restaurants all around the place. So in that sense, how do you put a value on that that can be attributable back to the Olympics? Would it have happened? Could it have happened if it not been for the Games? Yes, it probably could. But would there have been the political will? Probably not. So the metrics that you use to determine whether it is seen as a success or not can be as fluid as the day is long. The one thing that you can't get away from is that embedded infrastructural cost. If you are going to build what you see as being an iconic city-defining stadium, and in reality, that's probably, those days are probably gone. That I think, you know, the fancy architects that can come in and you know, sort of build their own dream at the expense of the city, probably gone.
We tend to forget about the Winter Olympics when we talk about the Olympics, but some of the biggest financial disasters and requiring big bailouts either from their states or their national governments have been the Winter Olympics. Lake Placid in New York in 1980, Lillehammer in Norway in 1994, Sochi, Putin's extravaganza in 2010. A lot of the time because these are very small communities and people tend not to visit all year round afterwards.
Yeah, I think Lillehammer's population is about the size of Finglas. So I'm not sure that Finglas is ever going to host the Winter Olympic Games. Well, that would be an infrastructural cost to build mountains. I don't think we're ever going to go there. But you're right. Like I guess the number of places that are likely to be able to host a Winter Olympics are much less because you do. You need mountains, you need skiing, you need snow and everything else. So your big population centres and your big cities are ruled out of that. It just can't possibly happen. So that smaller window perhaps means that those countries and those cities which do have a ski heritage and a ski infrastructure that will go for it. In reality, you look at it and you see an Olympic Games as being it's a sporting contest whereby, you know, there will be 10,000 or 12,000 athletes that will come together in a city. The reality is, and the logistics of it is, that isn't a huge number. You'd get as many people that will come in, like we'll have, you know, 50,000 people coming into Dublin to watch a match in the Aviva, or 80,000 coming in to watch a match in Croke Park. Putting the athletes in place and putting the crowds that go around them, it's a logistical exercise that can and should be managed quite well. And it's really the sort of the ego of cities that has got them, are the ones that have got them into trouble. You look back at London and you'd see that it would be a success, even with the cost of building that extra infrastructure. I'm pretty sure that Paris is going to be pretty good in 4 years' time. Tokyo have obviously begun to realise that they were looking at too much. There have already been a number of the facilities there that have been pared back and cancelled in some cases, because reality, when reality bites on ambition, that can sometimes be a rude wake-up call.
Is the lesson of history that it is going to be big cities that can behave sensibly but at the same time absorb the cost that is necessary, have the logistics and accommodation capacity already in place, that they're going to increasingly win the Olympics, that there's going to be a smaller number of applicants? We see Paris next time out, Los Angeles already 2028.
Mm-hmm. I think if you're living in a city which has got the capacity, has got the facilities already in place to host major sporting events, and that is an awful lot of cities now at this present time. Like the Olympics is still it's a closed loop. There's only a certain number of sports that can take place. Even London had, you know, the sailing events that were happening way down the south coast, and you had rowing events that were happening up at Henley. So it was dispersed according to the facilities that are there. Back in the day, it could have been that they would have decided to build an entire new rowing centre somewhere in the heart of London. But reality is that you didn't need to. You didn't need to have everything on a single Olympic park. Barcelona was using facilities that were already in place there from previous sporting events. And that does seem to be the key to it. Even when you look at our own bid for the Rugby World Cup, we weren't building any specific new stadia. We were investing and upgrading the infrastructure in the existing facilities that we do have. And we were going to be building a new casement park up for the with the GAA up in Belfast, but that was going to be there on the cards anyway. We weren't specifically going out to build a brand new national rugby stadium in order to just attract in a competition. And I think if anybody had suggested that we should, they would have gotten fairly short shift.
Yeah, interesting lessons being learned, perhaps slowly, about what cities can absorb in terms of hosting major sporting events, particularly the Olympics. Whatever way it goes in Tokyo, we know from the World Cup they'll host a fine competition, but we'll leave it there. Rob Hartnett, Founder and Chief Executive of Sport for Business, thanks indeed for coming into us.
Thank you, Vincent.
Well, that's it from this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings at newstalk.com and on the Newstalk app. So for now, from Taking Stock, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think change. Think PwC. Think beyond. pwc.ie